This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. Enron founder Ken Lay dies suddenly. What does this mean for those seeking redress? And a Latino gang accused of killing African Americans. Joining us today to discuss these topics from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., economist and author Julianne Malveau. She's president and CEO of Last Word Productions. And in our New York bureau, Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Also there, Pedro Noguera. He's a professor of education at New York University. All right, folks, let's talk about what shocked everyone this week, and that is the sudden death of Ken Lay. He was awaiting his time in jail, was in fact going to spend the rest of his life in jail. Julianne Malveau, let me go to you. So many people talking about the legacy he leaves, but what does this mean for the families who were going to seek redress against him?
Ed, that's the big question, because after all, you have thousands of people who lost their pensions, and the issue was whether they were going to be recovering from the Lay and the Skilling estates from what they had accumulated. And now that Ken Lay has died legally, it's a weaker case to go after his estate, to go after his wife. And so, first of all, Skilling will probably bear the brunt of the nation's anger and may well mean that he has a stiffer sentence and also a greater fine. But Linda Lay may well end up, you know, with at least the $10 million he's had an investment account. Certainly his net worth has plummeted. Much of his worth was in Enron stock. But he still, $10 million is not inconsequential, especially to the person who was a secretary or the janitor at Enron who lost their whole entire pension. But she may be able to keep that. The law is very murky on whether or not you can go after an estate when someone has died. So, you know, not to be cynical, but Ken Lay died. One wonders, you know, some are going to say he was hounded to death. One wondered if he didn't wish himself there only because it does protect his inheritors.
Yeah, interesting enough, Pedro, one sees a man go from hundreds of millions of dollars to, in comparison, a pittance at $10 million, as Julianne suggested, anywhere from 8 to 10. His wife obviously trying to protect those assets for her and the family. But one has to allow for the fact, even if the Justice Department and others were to go after these assets, $8 million or $10 million certainly wouldn't be able to fill the coffers of all of those who want money back from the losses they received from this scandal.
No, it won't. And the sad thing is that there will be no justice here for the millions or that have been affected by the implosion of Enron, for the people who work there. And it raises so many questions about particularly the Bush administration. Many people forget how close George Bush was personally with Ken Lay. He referred to him as Kenny Boy Lay. That was his partner. He used his private jet during his first campaign for office. The ties between the Bush administration and Enron were very strong. And what is very interesting about this case is how little has been done to expose those connections. We've isolated Lay as though he were the sole culprit, when in fact his ties ran very deep within the Republican Party.
Walter, the idea that here is a man whose legacy has obviously clearly been tarnished, but it will stand as one of those red letters, if you will, in terms of how America will continue to look at corporate America for some time.
Well, you know, I've heard of cheating death. Ken Lay cheated sentencing. I mean, you have to give him credit for taking his fate in his own hands. You know, when you look at this scandal, it's such a large, of large magnitude that you can't even begin to fathom the impact of the fall of Enron. And I think it has caused many people to pay closer attention to what goes on inside of corporations and corporate boardrooms. Because don't forget, Ken Lay was the CEO, but there was a board of directors of Enron. I mean, there are a whole lot of people responsible for what happened at Enron. And I think more and more we're going to look at the issue of responsibility of directors, because they too can be sued. And that's why they now take out insurance, liability insurance. The fact of the matter is, I think the prosecutors will go after Ken Lay's estate. I don't think the claims die just because they bury Ken Lay. I think that they will go after any assets that the Lay estate has to try to make sure that there's at least some compensation for victims of the Enron fall. But I think once again, it's making many of us pay closer attention to what goes on inside of corporate America.
We talk about fair when it relates to Enron. Let's talk about being fair to one's family if you had, quote, end quote, nothing to do with it. Julianne Malveau, what about the wife and the family?
Well, this is like reparations at some level, Ed. You know, contemporary white people said they had nothing to do with slavery, but the fact is that people who are descendants of slaves have been harmed. And so indeed, while Linda Lay may well be non-culpable, and that's a big old question mark because she worked at Enron. She's the second wife who apparently was a partner at some point, not a formal partner, but she knew what was going on. But setting that aside,
well, there's question to how much she knew.
Okay,
we should note that.
That's fair. But setting that aside, the fact is that you inherit an estate because of someone's accumulated actions over time. So she should not be held harmless. Indeed, I think that Walter is right that the government should go after, but I think that the law is very murky here. The fact is that, you know, if you inherit, you know, whatever from whomever, and whomever has harmed me, I should not be denied the opportunity to get my just due. You have thousands of people who will not get their just due. And, you know, it's very interesting because Ken Lay literally was a hands-off CEO until about the 6 months period before Enron folded. But in that period, he sent an email to all employees encouraging them to buy more stock. And he claimed he was buying it too, but he knew what was going on, and he was encouraging people, working class people with incomes under $40,000 or $50,000, while his was ballooned into the millions, to buy more stock. Yes, they should go after Linda Lay, and she should be consigned to the same opportunity that those people who work for Enron had, which is, you know, to live on a modest wage.
All right, let's turn our attention to another story, Pedro, and that is the question of the reemergence of Cindy Sheehan, the mother and anti-war activist who lost a son in the war and went directly to President Bush in an attempt to stop this war. We are now hearing a nationwide effort dubbed Troops Home Fast, and that is 3,000 people from the United States and 18 other countries have signed up to fast until September 1st, including Danny Glover, Al Sharpton, Susan Sarandon, and many other celebrities in an attempt to bring more attention to the war and the attempt to stop it.
Well, I think this is a noteworthy and noble cause that Cindy Sheehan and Danny Glover and others have launched. I'm still not convinced that this is going to do the trick in getting the troops back. These kinds of protests are so dependent upon media coverage. If there's no coverage, they will fast in silence. And as we know, if there's no attention, no media coverage, then no one knows, and the Congress doesn't begin to feel the pressure. The country's still very divided about its the war, despite the fact that it does seem that the majority of Americans oppose it now. But I would say that these kinds of actions by themselves may not be enough to turn the tide.
Walter, the idea that others like Willie Nelson and Sean Penn will assure it coverage up front, but as Pedro astutely puts it, if the media doesn't continue to cover this, and if you don't see a huge turnout the first couple of days, this really does fall by the wayside. One can look at the concerted effort that Cindy Sheehan and others made initially, received a lot of coverage, and then seemed to fizzle.
Well, I think at the end of the day, this will be a more effective diet than Jenny Craig. I mean, I think that what we have here is just, you know, symbolism. Unfortunately, when you see how the Bush administration has dug its heels in on Iraq, and I think the reason why they've dug their heels in is because the economics have not played out for them. There's still this question of all that oil and the fact that they don't have control of all that oil. And I don't think they have any intention of leaving Iraq until they have some semblance of how they make the economics work for them. So I think we can have all these symbolic efforts, and I think we get a lot of media coverage. But the fact of the matter is, it's not only in the U.S., but around the world, there's worldwide condemnation right now of the United States because of our actions in Iraq. And that really hasn't moved this administration at all. So I think unless we have a change in the midterm elections in November of a House of Representatives that goes over to the Democratic side that can impeach this president, that you won't see any of these type of efforts really have any influence upon this White House.
Julianne?
You know, I'm concerned about this fast for a couple of reasons. I agree with both of my colleagues in what they've said, but this is kind of a tag team fast. I mean, these folks are not going to fast from now until September 1st. They're going to fast on certain days. So you're also denied, Pedro, what you talk about media, of the vision of somebody wasting away. I mean, when Sharpton went down to Vieques, he fasted for 45 days, and you saw a different Sharpton emerge. Now, he didn't cut his hair, but anyway, you still saw a different Sharpton emerge. If people are fasting one day a week, you're literally denied the drama of what a fast means and, you know, the whole notion of intervention. So while I think anything we do to protest this war is important, I'm really raising questions about the efficacy of this action of basically enrolling a whole bunch of celebrities in, okay, I'm a fast on Tuesday, you fast on Wednesday. So it's like a tag team fast. It's just not the same thing. I mean, fast one day a week. You know?
We should note that the others and the activists, and we don't know, I would suspect there may be a celebrity or two who will join in, will in fact remain on the diet of water, teas, and juices until the 1st. And which,
well, I hope so.
The symbolism there is International Peace Day on September 1.
I applaud them, would join them. I'll fast on Thursdays, you know, whatever. But that's not the point. The point is that the way that fasts have predictably worked in the past is that you've seen this person wasting away, and that's added to the media drama. With this kind of thing, it's going to be very easy for media to downplay this, symbolism notwithstanding. And the fact is that this administration does not really care if Sharpton, Glover, Sheehan, or others are wasting away.
Do, in fact, Pedro, you need a poster child for this? Do you need Cindy Sheehan or one particular celebrity to, in fact, try to fast as, you know, became so famous with Dick Gregory from now to September 1?
I think that by itself, that's not going to do it. Doesn't matter, I think, almost who it is. I think it's going to be the events in Iraq, ultimately, how that war plays out. Now, we've seen, you know, tragedy after tragedy unfold. But it's going to take something significant over there to change the tide for Americans to finally say, listen, this is unwinnable. This is untenable. We've just got to pull them out. And so I don't think the protests by themselves, no matter who it is, will do the trick.
All right, Walter, here's an interesting aside to all of what we're talking about. And certainly we've seen this historically throughout when wars were about. We haven't heard as much about this. And again, don't know if the numbers are the same or just the coverage as Pedro has suggested has been different. But an Army lieutenant has refused deployment to Iraq because he says the war is illegal. He was charged with three counts. It could face nearly 8 years in prison and dishonorable discharge if convicted. He's been charged with conduct unbecoming an officer, missing movement, and contempt toward officials. So what we see is, again, one of these poster children standing up and saying, I'm willing to put my neck on the line.
But I think he has a very weak case. I mean, this is a volunteer army that he volunteered to become a part of. And the fact of the matter is when you enlist, you can't pick and choose the war that you want to fight. I mean, he's saying that I'll go to Afghanistan, but don't send me to Iraq. I mean, I think his case is extremely weak. We have to remember that at one time, the Department of Defense was the Department of War. There's a reason why we have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. They fight wars. So if you're an enlisted officer and all of a sudden you find a war that you don't happen to like and say, hey, can I sit this one out until this next one comes around that I kind of like better? I think he has a very weak case, and I don't think he's that great of a symbol for us at this time, for those of us who want to see this end.
Julianne, some might take the other side of that coin and suggest because it is a volunteer army, if in fact you believe that this war is illegal, you really should be able to step away.
Yeah, I really profoundly disagree with Walter on this. I actually think that the case is a strong case. I think also that when we look at it, it's not quite a volunteer army. Their people are there because of an economic draft. If you look at the fact that people of color, frankly, who drop out of high school are so unlikely to find jobs, 78% of the black men who are high school dropouts are unemployed, there is an implicit economic draft for many people. Now, that put aside, I think that this man, Mr. Watada, is making a case that's an important case. And though legally it may be weak, I think morally it's very strong. And so I applaud him. I think it's wonderful. I think as much pressure that comes on this White House to stop this war and to look at it is important. And this is another source of pressure. There may have been others that we haven't heard about because, indeed, the media has been biased towards protecting Mr. Bush around this war.
All right, Pedro, you can break the tie.
Well, I would say, again, it's the accumulation of actions. It's the protests by the hunger strikers. It's these individual acts of defiance by soldiers who are serving. It's the pressure from abroad, from U.S. allies and others. Together, this creates the pressure, but what will really determine whether or not this White House is forced to pull troops out is what happens in these midterm elections, I think, because they're determined right now, if we look at what they're doing, to use the war as a campaign strategy. They're not running away from it. They're running to it. They believe they can continue to rally the country behind the idea that they're fighting terrorism in Iraq. And I think until that idea becomes so clearly bankrupt, that we will find that even with these acts of courage by this lieutenant, that they will be sacrificed in the name of this war.
And Walter, real quick for me, Pedro brings up an interesting point, and that is what I was going to suggest, in that the midterm election certainly will turn up the heat politically, where Republicans will go and utilize the war. Those who are anti-war are going to have to do the same thing.
They're going to have to do the same thing, but the problem is you have a lot of Democrats that supported that war resolution are still weak on the question of war. And in terms of this individual case, I don't think he's a great moral standard bearer either. I mean, this guy is basically saying, I don't like the Iraq war. I like the Afghanistan war better. I'll go serve there. So if you're really a moral standard bearer, you object to war, period. He didn't apply to be a conscious objector. He finds himself in a situation where I think he's seeing the body count in Iraq, and he's saying, I don't want to go to Iraq. And I understand the circumstances why people are being, you know, pushed into military service, but you cannot go in there and then decide what war best suits you. He's an officer in the United States Army. It's an unfortunate circumstance, but you know what? Sometimes you got to suck it up, and I think he's got an extremely weak case morally and legally.
All right. All right, Julianne, truly, 30 seconds.
You know, I think he has a strong case. I think that, you know, he says he's not opposed to war. Obviously, you can't go into the army and be opposed to war, but this war isn't a legal war. We went in there because there were so-called weapons of mass destruction. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? We have not found them. I think he's on solid and sound ground. I think anybody who is a military who is not drafted and volunteered can't say they're against war, because that's what armies do. But you can say you're against this one.
All right. Pedro, Julianne, and Walter, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.